Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are wading into what I think might be the murkiest waters we've ever navigated.
That's a good way to put it.
We are tackling a topic that, depending on who you listen to, is either the future of the entire global economy or, you know, a massive unregulated casino built on code.
That is a pretty accurate description of the polarization here.
We are talking about DeFi. Decentralized finance.
Yeah.
And I have to be honest with you right up front. When I see those four letters, my brain immediately goes to hype, scams, crypto bros, and just confusing charts that go to zero.
Right.
It feels like the Wild West. But we have a stack of documents here, specifically an Intro to DeFi course module and a workbook called Foundations of DeFi that claim we need to look past all that noise.
They do. And they make a pretty bold argument right out of the gate. They argue that DeFi isn't just about speculating on, you know, whatever the flavor of the month token is. They argue it's a fundamental restructuring of how trust works in money.
Trusting code instead of companies.
That's the core thesis. We are moving from a system of financial services, which are run by people in suits and tall buildings, to financial logic, which is run by software on a network.
So our mission today is to strip away the jargon. I want to figure out how you can actually have banking without banks. Without it all just being a Ponzi scheme?
Yeah.
And we need to unpack this analogy the source material loves, which is comparing the future of finance to a vending machine.
It's surprisingly the best analogy I've seen for this. It really is.
But before we get to the vending machine, let's set the stage a bit.
Right.
Why do the sources say we even need this shift? What is so broken about, you know, the guy in the suit that we need to replace him with a robot?
Well, the workbook opens with a critique of what they call TradFi, traditional finance.
TradFi.
It points out that for the last, say, 500 years, if you wanted to move value from point A to point B, you absolutely needed a middleman. You needed a ledger keeper.
Because I can't just hand you digital money directly. I need my bank to verify I actually have the money and that I'm not, you know, spending it twice.
You need a source of truth. The bank checks the ledger, subtracts from you, adds to me, and of course takes a fee for the privilege.
Oh, yeah.
But the source argues that this creates a gatekeeper problem. The gatekeeper decides who gets in, the gatekeeper sets the hours.
And the gatekeeper can just shut the doors.
Right.
Or just say no.
Or wait 3 days. Or pay us $35 because you overdrew by a dollar. DeFi is the suggestion that we can replace that human gatekeeper with a shared public database that, well, that runs itself.
Okay, let's get to the analogy, because I think this is where it starts to click for me. The source says, DeFi is like a vending machine. Walk me through this, because my bank has a lobby and, you know, free coffee. A vending machine has stale chips.
Mm. Think about the mechanism of the transaction. Think about the experience of buying a soda from a corner store versus a vending machine.
Where?
If you go to a store, there's a shopkeeper. That is the human element.
All right.
Maybe the shopkeeper is on a lunch break and the door's locked. Maybe he thinks you look suspicious and doesn't want to serve you. Maybe he charges you $2, but charges his friend $1. There is subjectivity.
Arbitrary rules based on the person in charge. I get it.
Now think about the vending machine. It's just a glass box in a hallway. Does the vending machine care who you are?
No. It cares if I have a dollar.
Does it care if it's 3 a.m. on a Sunday? Does it ask to see your ID or run a credit check before dispensing a Snickers bar?
Definitely not. It's purely input equals output.
That is the philosophy of DeFi. The source says to imagine a vending machine, but instead of dispensing snacks, it dispenses loans, or it swaps currencies for you. It is a financial service stripped of the human judgment and the human hours.
Okay, I get the concept. But a vending machine is a physical box with gears and coils. If we take the bank manager out of the equation, what are the gears in DeFi? What is actually doing the work?
That's where we get to the technical term, smart contracts.
I always found that name a bit misleading. They aren't really smart, like AI, and they aren't contracts, like a lawyer would write, right?
No, that's a common misconception. The source describes them as self-executing scripts. Think of it as just if-then logic, like a spreadsheet formula that no one can delete.
So if cell A1 is greater than 10,
then move funds to cell B2. Exactly. In DeFi, it might look like this. If a user deposits $100 worth of Bitcoin as collateral, then allow them to borrow $50 worth of stablecoins.
And that logic is just baked into the code.
It's written into the code. It lives on the blockchain. Once it's deployed, it just runs automatically.
So there's no committee reviewing my loan application. No one checking my pay stubs.
There is no committee. The code simply checks, did you put in the collateral? Yes, here is the loan. It takes milliseconds.
That sounds incredibly efficient, but also a little cold.
It is cold. Mm-hmm. It's ruthless efficiency. But the source argues that the flip side of cold is fair. The code treats a billionaire and a college student exactly the same. If you satisfy the logic, the transaction happens.
All right, so we have the philosophy, but I want to get concrete because efficiency is a nice buzzword, but I want to know how this actually works. The intro to DeFi lesson has this infographic that I found really helpful. It's like a translation dictionary.
The DeFi stack. Yeah, this is where we see the nuts and bolts.
Old world versus new world. Let's run through a few of these. In the old world, the bread and butter of finance is the stock exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, guys yelling on phones.
A centralized building where brokers meet to match buyers and sellers. In DeFi, this becomes the DX, the decentralized exchange.
Now, explain this to me like I'm five. Because if there's no broker matching orders and I want to sell a token, who buys it? Do I have to wait for another user to show up?
This is a crucial distinction the source makes, and it's where people often get lost. In a traditional exchange, you have an order book. I list my share for $10, and I wait for someone to agree to pay
$10. If there's matching pairs.
But DeFi introduced something called an AM, an automated market maker. Don't let the name scare you. Think of it as a big robotic pool of money.
A pool of money. A literal bucket.
A literal bucket. Imagine a bucket with 50% US dollars and 50% euros. If I want to swap my dollars for euros, I don't need to find a person. I just throw my dollars into the bucket and take the equivalent euros out. The robot, the smart contract, automatically adjusts the price based on how much is left in the bucket.
So the vending machine is the counterparty.
Yeah.
I'm trading against the machine.
You're trading against the pool. And this concept, liquidity pools, is foundational. It allows trading to happen 24/7 without needing a broker to pick up the phone.
Okay, that brings me to the next one on the list. Savings accounts. In the real world, I park my cash in a bank, and they pay me a whopping 0.01% interest if I'm lucky. In DeFi, this becomes what?
Lending protocols. Remember that bucket we just talked about?
Yeah.
Where does the money in the bucket come from?
I assumed.
Yeah.
The developers or the company that made the protocol.
In DeFi, there is no company. The money comes from users. You can put your money into that bucket for others to trade against. And because you are providing the liquidity that makes the system work, you get the fees.
Wait, so the yield isn't magic money printed out of thin air?
No, and that's a really important point to make because lots of scams do print money out of thin air. But in legitimate DeFi protocols, the yield comes from borrowers paying interest or traders paying transaction fees.
So instead of the bank taking the fee, paying for their marble lobby, paying their CEO a bonus and giving me the crumbs.
You get the fee.
I get the fee.
That's the yield component. The source calls it becoming the bank. You are providing the capital, so you earn the return.
Which explains why the rates are often so much higher. It's just cutting out the middleman, taking their cut.
Correct. Though, hold that thought, because higher reward usually comes with much, much higher risk, which we have to discuss.
Oh, we will get to the risk. I have a lot of red flags waving in my mind. But first, I want to touch on this concept of money Legos. The workbook mentions composability. It sounds like tech jargon, but they claim it's a superpower.
It is huge. Think about the banking world today. If you have a Wells Fargo account and you want to use a product from Chase and then invest that through Robinhood, those systems hate talking to each other.
They're silos. Transferring money between them takes days.
In DeFi, because everything is built on the same open standard, usually a blockchain like Ethereum, the protocols are like Lego bricks. They snap together.
Give me a real-world example of what that lets you do, not just theory.
Okay, imagine the stack. You have a savings Lego where you deposit some collateral, say Ethereum. You snap a borrowing Lego on top of it to automatically take out a loan in stablecoins against that savings. Then you snap an investing Lego on top of that to automatically put that borrowed money into one of those liquidity pools we talked about.
And you can do that all at once.
A developer can write a single piece of code that does all of that in one click. You can build complex financial strategies that would take weeks of paperwork in the real world and execute them in seconds.
That sounds incredibly powerful, but also really complicated. I feel like I'd need a PhD to operate these Legos.
It is complex.
Yeah.
And that leads us perfectly to the simulation in the workbook. Because the theory is nice, but the user experience is, well, it's very different.
Right. This is phase two of the workbook,
yeah.
The $500 savings test. It asks us to take a hypothetical $500 and try to save it in both systems.
It's a great reality check.
So scenario A is the bank. You have $500 cash. You walk into your local branch. What happens?
Well, first, check your watch. Is it 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.? Is it a weekday?
If it's Saturday afternoon, I'm out of luck.
Right. Then you walk in. You need ID, proof of address. If you're under 18 or have no credit history, or if you just moved to the country, they might show you the door.
The source emphasizes that bankability is a permission status.
They decide if you are worthy.
And let's say they let me in. I deposit my $500.
You get, according to the source's data, roughly 0.5% APY. So after a year, your $500 has earned about $2.50.
Wow. Can't even buy a fancy coffee with that. Okay, scenario B, DeFi. I have $500 worth of a digital stablecoin.
First off, no hours. You can do this at 3 a.m. in your pajamas. You open a lending protocol website. You click deposit.
No ID. No social security number.
No ID. No name. No address. The protocol doesn't know who you are. It just knows your wallet address, which is just a string of letters and numbers. The source says anyone with an internet connection is bankable.
That is a massive shift in accessibility.
Right.
But I have to play devil's advocate here. Actually, not even devil's advocate, just common sense. In the bank scenario, I hand my cash to a teller. It feels safe. The FDIC insures it.
Sure.
In the DeFi scenario, I'm clicking a button on a website. It feels flimsy. What if I click the wrong button? What if the website just disappears?
And that brings us to the crucial question the workbook asks, who has control?
In the bank, the bank controls the money. They hold it.
Which means they can freeze it, they can say suspicious activity and lock you out, but it also means if you lose your debit card, you can call them and say, help me.
Right. There is a customer service desk. There is a password reset.
In DeFi, you have absolute control. No one can freeze your wallet. No government can shut down the protocol because it lives on thousands of computers globally.
But.
Here comes the but.
Because you have absolute control. You have absolute responsibility. If you lose your password, your private key, that $500 is gone.
Gone. Like contact support.
Yeah.
Gone. There is no support. It is mathematically impossible to recover it. If you send the money to the wrong address, gone. If you get tricked into signing a bad transaction, gone.
That is the pivotal trade-off. We are trading permission for responsibility. And honestly, that's scary. The Intro to DeFi lesson has a whole section on risks. And it's not just about losing your password. It calls it a dark forest.
We have to do the safety briefing. We have to talk about smart contract risk.
The bugs in the machine.
Remember, these protocols are written by humans, and humans make typos. Humans make logic errors. In the software world, if Instagram has a bug, maybe the app crashes and you can't see pictures of lunch.
Right. An annoyance.
In DeFi, if a smart contract has a bug, hackers can drain the entire liquidity pool.
Has that actually happened, or is this theoretical?
The source cites billions of dollars lost to exploits. Imagine walking up to that vending machine we talked about, pressing a secret combination of buttons, and the machine spits out all the money inside. That happens in DeFi.
That is terrifying. So you're not just betting on the market going up or down, you're betting on the code quality of the vending machine.
You're auditing the code with your money. And then there's regulatory risk.
The people in suits fighting back.
Well, governments are still figuring out how to handle this. Is a vending machine that dispenses loans a bank? Should it be regulated like a bank? If the government decides to ban the interface you use, accessing your money might get very difficult technically.
And let's not forget volatility. We're talking about stablecoins mostly. But if you're using other tokens, the value can drop 50% overnight.
Absolutely. The workbook is very clear. High yield equals high risk. If you see a protocol offering 20% interest, that risk is coming from somewhere. Usually it's the risk of the code breaking, the asset collapsing, or the whole thing just being unsustainable.
So I'm listening to this and I'm hearing potential bugs, no customer support, hackers draining pools, complex tools, and if I lose my key, I lose everything. Why on earth would anyone do this? Why does the source material call this the future? Sounds like a headache.
It's a fair question. Why leave the safety of the bank? The source boils it down to three main pillars: access, efficiency, and transparency.
Well, let's hit access again, because for me, sitting here with a bank account, maybe doesn't matter.
We take banking for granted, but the source points out there are billions of unbanked people worldwide, people who don't have the paperwork, people who live in countries with unstable currencies or corrupt banking systems.
Mm-hmm.
For them, DeFi offers a global Swiss bank account in their pocket that is revolutionary for human rights and economic inclusion.
That is compelling. If you can't trust your local bank, you trust the global code. What about transparency?
Think about the 2008 financial crisis. Banks were taking massive risks with people's money, leveraging it up, and no one knew until it all collapsed. It was a black box.
We just had to trust they knew what they were doing.
In DeFi, it's a glass box. Because everything is on the blockchain, you can see exactly where the money is. You can see the collateral. You can see the solvency of the protocol in real time.
Don't trust, verify.
Exactly. And finally, efficiency. By removing the brick-and-mortar branches, the corporate jets, and the middle management layers, the cost of finance drops. That means cheaper loans for borrowers and higher yields for lenders. It tightens the spread.
It really is a double-edged sword, isn't it? On one side, you have this utopian vision of a fair, open, efficient financial system. On the other side, you have a rugged, unforgiving landscape where one wrong click costs you everything.
It reminds me of the early internet. Think about the web in the 90s. It was messy, it was confusing, it was full of scams. You had to know how to use a modem, but it also changed everything.
So what's the takeaway here? If I'm not ready to dump my life savings into a smart contract, which, for the record, I am definitely not, what should I be thinking about?
The workbook ends with a self-check that I think is the perfect lingering thought. It asks us to redefine what it means to be financially literate. For our parents, financial literacy was balancing a checkbook. For us, it might be understanding credit scores and 401ks. But for the next generation, the source suggests financial literacy will be about key management.
Managing your own passwords.
Managing your own custody. Understanding how to interact with a protocol. We are moving from a world where institutions define your access to a world where your proficiency defines your access.
That is a profound distinction.
If the vending machine is open to everyone, the only barrier left is your own knowledge. It's not about permission anymore. It's about competence.
That puts the burden and the power squarely on our shoulders.
It does. It's a brave new world.
Well, that gives us plenty to chew on. Next time you swipe that debit card, take a second to think about the invisible Rube Goldberg machine of banks and processors making that happen, and ask yourself, are you ready to trade the teller for the code?
It's the million-dollar question.
Thanks for diving in with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. We'll catch you in the next deep dive.